Ladies and gentlemen, I believe we can start now. On behalf of the LSE Conservative Association, I'd like to welcome you all here today to our final speaker in a series of outside speakers. The Right Honourable Michael Portillo MP was first elected to Parliament for Enfield Southgate in a 1984 by-election and has since had a storming parliamentary career. Mr. Portillo has held various positions in government before becoming Chief Secretary to the Treasury in 1992. Many commentators, including former Prime Minister Baroness Thatcher, have predicted a continued successful political career for Mr. Portillo. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to remind you of the school's freedom of speech policy, like at any other meeting. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll give you the Right Honourable Michael Portillo MP. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, this is a pretty unusual occasion for me. I'm used to speaking in the House of Commons, and so it is pretty unusual for me to address a live audience. But clearly we do. Clearly we do have a pretty live audience today. May I say how very kind it is of you to come along in such numbers today. When you are, as I am, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, flinty-hearted, stony-faced, the mad axeman of the cabinet, it's very difficult to get anyone to come along and share a room with me at all. So Indeed, I accepted this invitation quite a long time ago, and your chairman rang me up and said, "Look, I'm very sorry," he said, "ticket sales aren't going very well." And I said, "Oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. What seems to be the problem?" And he said, "Well, you know, I'm afraid you're not a very controversial figure and nobody's heard of you." So he asked me if there was anything I could do about that. So when I went to Southampton University on one occasion, I thought that I might make a few controversial comments about A-levels and so on, and I'm very pleased to see that it's had the effect of bringing a larger audience today. You know, I've been called worse things than that. When I first took over this job of being Chief Secretary, one of my friends said to me, "You're going to need all your political courage, you know, to do this job." So I look back over my career to try and remember when I'd had to use political courage before. I did remember that during my by-election I'd been canvassing from door to door, and I was trying to show that I was young and fit, and so I came to quite a short gate, leapt over the gate, ran up the path, knocked on the door. The door was opened by a very large gentleman indeed, and as he opened the door to me, I became aware of a certain stickiness under my feet. And looking back down his pathway, it had been freshly concreted, and my footprints were left in his pathway. So this very large man saw me in his ruined pathway at about the same time, and he said to me, "Who are you?" Or words to that effect. Anyway, I don't quote him verbatim. So I thought, well, here is a moment for great political courage. So I looked that man directly in the eye, I straightened my spine, and I said, "Sir, I have the honour to be your parliamentary candidate for the Labour Party." And I recommend that course of action to any of you. I want to start talking about the job that I do in government. About 18 months ago, there had been a loss of confidence in this country due to the long endurance of the recession and following the events when we left the exchange rate mechanism. And my task with the two chancellors of the Exchequer that I've been serving has been to make sure that we restore confidence fully in British economic policy and British economic management. And we've done that under three headings. First of all, under monetary policy, we have made sure that people know the reasons why the government takes decisions on interest rates. The reasons will always be economic, they will never be political. We have made the process by which we take those interest rate decisions much more transparent. We have ensured that people know from the reports of the independent panel of forecasters the full range of views about the economy. We make sure that by publishing the minutes of the meetings between the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Governor of the Bank of England, that people know what went on in those discussions. And all of that is in order to ensure that people know that the objective of our interest rate policy is to sustain downward pressure on inflation and thus enable the conditions to exist in this country where people can have confidence and where we can have non-inflationary growth. The second thing we've had to do is to restrain public spending. Public spending is now at about 45% of gross domestic product, and we are committed to reduce the proportion of the national income which is spent by the government. For the 3 years that are ahead, we have committed ourselves to take £15 billion off the plans for public spending that had been made. And that means that over the next 3 years, there will be only the slightest increase in the new control total of public spending. Controlling public spending is part of making sure that the government lives within its means. And that brings me to the third heading, which is public borrowing. We have had to demonstrate to the world that the government is serious about the business of bringing public borrowing firmly under control. And that has meant public spending restraint, but it has also meant some rises in taxation. It is necessary for the government to bring its income and its expenditure into line one with the other, just as it is necessary for every business and every family in this country to make sure that what they receive and what they spend balance. And the government cannot plan to be exceeding its income in what it spends on a sustained basis from year to year. Now, we have shown that we will bring the PSBR down to zero before the end of the decade. And that has been a very important part of re-establishing confidence in British economic policy. During the course of last year, when the PSBR, the public sector borrowing requirement, was very high, the rates of interest nonetheless fell during the course of the year. Now, when the government is imposing such a very strong demand on the markets, you wouldn't necessarily expect interest rates to be falling. But confidence in the markets that the government was in earnest about bringing its borrowing under firm control meant that interest rates during last year could fall. There was no funding crisis, and the recovery was able to continue. Today, that recovery seems to me to be very widespread. It has gone from one sector to another. For example, retail sales today are at their highest level that they have ever been. We've seen production rising and productivity rising, and recently we've seen the recovery spreading even to the property market, which is very often the last sector of the economy to benefit. We've seen unemployment falling. Unemployment has come down by about 250,000 from the peak, and we've seen employment rising. So the economy is recovering in a widespread way. The economy is recovering at a rate which is clearly sustainable. We have seen no evidence whatsoever of the recurrence of inflation. And I underline that it is our determination, our clear determination, to keep those inflationary pressures in check. As we go through this recovery, as the recovery becomes more widespread and clearer in its standing, our mind turns to the very important matter of making sure that Britain is competitive. Manufacturing industry has performed extremely well over the last couple of years. We've seen very sharp increases in manufacturing productivity, so that productivity now stands today higher than it has ever been before. We've also seen that British management has kept good control of the wage costs in industry, so that unit wage costs in Britain for a while were falling and recently have been under firm control, whereas in places like Germany and Japan, unit wage costs have been rising more steeply. So all of those are good indicators. And we see today that our share of world trade in manufactured goods has stabilized after some decades in which it has been in decline. We expect to see exports in the coming year rising faster than consumption in the economy. All of that is very good news. We're determined to keep Britain competitive. Going into the social chapter of the Maastricht Treaty would have been a terrible error, because companies which are investing across Europe are now frequently reporting that some of the best places to do business are in Britain. They find not that the wage costs in Britain are the lowest in Europe, but that the additional costs imposed by government on employers, those national insurance and social security costs, are in Britain some of the lowest in Europe. And that gives us a very important competitive advantage. And we recognize in Britain that we have to do more than merely compete within the European Union. We have to compete on a global basis, because Britain today still exports a greater proportion of her GDP than does Japan, and Britain's exports per head are greater than those of Japan. And so we are addressing ourselves to being competitive internationally, and to have imposed extra costs upon British business through joining the social chapter would not have been helpful to that purpose. Looking around the world today, you find countries all over the world are pursuing an economic agenda which many of them believe was exported to them by Britain. They are following an agenda of competitiveness, of privatization, of free markets, of low tariffs, of free trade, and of course they are pursuing an agenda of political freedom, and on each of those Britain has been in the lead, and on each of those Britain has been the most supportive. So around the world you find countries pursuing that agenda, the agenda that we have been pursuing in Britain. And of course it is our ambition for all of Europe that the same agenda of competitiveness, of free trade, of low tariffs, of deregulation, of privatization should also be the agenda for the European community. What is so depressing is to find that the other political parties seem to have no confidence in Britain. The Labour and the Liberal Democrat parties have both already committed themselves to a central European state. That is not something that the Conservatives will have anything to do with. The Labour and Liberal Democrats seem to believe that Britain is not able to govern herself. They seem to have given up hope on Britain. The Conservatives begin from a position of confidence about Britain, recognising our role in the world, recognising the importance of the agenda that we've followed at home, recognising that that agenda is being pursued around the world, and recognising that that agenda has a great deal to offer Europe as well. So, I hope that all of you Conservatives, in this... In this very distinguished College of Learning, in this college in which economic understanding is very high, will join in the Conservative vision which we will be putting forward in the European elections, the Conservative vision of a free trading Europe in a free trading world, of a Europe which follows this agenda of competitiveness, of privatization, of low tariffs, and of free trade. And if you do give us support in these important elections on that important agenda, then I believe that we shall have great success. Thank you very much indeed.
Mr. Patilias, kindly agree to take questions. We start from Leo here. Just speak from the floor.
I think I will go back. To begin with some background, in the United Kingdom, students frequently, generally, qualify to have their tuition fees paid by the taxpayer, and they also receive support from the taxpayer for their maintenance. I begin by saying that the support from the taxpayer for the maintenance of the student is very unusual, internationally speaking. There are very few places in the world where the taxpayer finances not only the tuition fees, but also the maintenance of the student. I think that there are three sorts of person who benefit from a student's education. One is obviously the country as a whole, that benefits from having highly educated people. The next is the family of the student. They obviously have joy in the success of the student. And the other is the student himself or herself. And I think that it is only fair that the maintenance and support of students should be shared between those three elements. You have to remember that the money which is presently being paid to students for their maintenance comes from taxpayers. And many taxpayers are very poor, and many taxpayers have not had the opportunities to enjoy higher education. And therefore, I think it is right that the student should make a contribution through a loans element towards the student's maintenance. The loans only have to be repaid if the student is in work, and as I recall, if the student's income is at 85% of the average wage. I think that that is a perfectly fair system. We have to be fair to everyone in this country, including the taxpayers.
Gentlemen in the centre.
I think our influence in the world, it really comes in two parts. One, our own individual standing. And I do think that we do have an individual standing. We are members of the United Nations Security Council. We are very strong participants in United Nations action. We've taken a very strong stand as a nation for the encouragement of new political freedoms and the emergence of new political democracies. And we have a long-standing reputation around the world because we have brought to many parts of the world good government, good administration, business ethics, and a great deal of investment. So obviously, a part of what Britain stands for is her individual contribution. But of course, and this is a decision that we took in 1973, Britain sees her influence as being greater and more broadly felt if she is a member of a European community, now a European Union. And it obviously is important, in order to get the most out of our membership, that we should be influential members within the European Union. I believe we are, and I believe we always will be, because of our size and our standing, and because of the very clear objectives for the European Union, which I've set out today.
Justin.
Good afternoon.
I was wondering what you think of people who go to universities such as
in Oxford and Cambridge, as far as I know, for many years and probably centuries, you qualify for an MA by the passage of 7 years from the time of your matriculation. And when you qualify for it, you are charged a fee. It's a long tradition. I'm perfectly happy with it.
The young, charming young lady over there.
I'm awfully glad you came. You are a great asset to our meeting, if I may say so. I've told you how the student loan system works. Students are lent money, and they're only required to repay it if they're in work, and if their salary or wage is at 85% of the national average. So there is no reason for that to deter anyone from any sort of background. But the facts of the matter are clear. Since we introduced a loan element within the maintenance amount, the participation rate for students has risen very sharply. Between 1979 and 1993, we've gone from 1 in 8 participating in higher education to nearly 1 in 3. And don't start screaming at me about the quality, because the quality is evident before us. There's no question to answer on tuition fees. There's no proposal by the government on tuition fees.
You've had your question. Mr. Russell. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Russell.
I can assure you that we're making no cuts in education. The amount that is spent on education rises in real terms every year, and not least, of course, because of the very large extra numbers of people who are in higher education. That's a policy of which I entirely approve, and it is a priority for the government, and it is the reason why, even within a constrained public spending total, the amount on education rises. That also helps our competitiveness, by the way. Now, I entirely reject what you say about xenophobia or whatever. I know that that is a charge that people like to make against government ministers, particularly if they've got an X as their middle initial, because it makes a good headline.
Jim in the centre. No, sorry, the other one before.
I'm slightly surprised if I can get through a speech without a note that you can't get through a question without having to read it, by the way. A little spontaneity goes a long way in a meeting. I don't believe that Britain was in any way humiliated by Malaysia. I'm sorry that some people tried to exploit difficulties between Britain and Malaysia. I'm sorry not least because a lot of British jobs depended upon good trading relations with Malaysia. I'd like to see good trading relations with Malaysia, and I don't want to say any more about the subject because diplomacy should be carried out quietly.
The young lady in front of the previous questioner.
By enabling them to have jobs. In Britain, 70% of the people of working age have jobs, are in employment. There is no major European country in which that proportion of the population is in work. I was speaking to a Spanish colleague the other day. I said, what proportion of your working age population is in work? And he said that he thought the figure was 45%. The difference between a country which has free markets, flexible labour markets, and those which are very, very constrained, is in the number of jobs that can be created. And Britain did create, during the 1980s, a very large number of jobs. We're creating jobs again today. We have a problem in Europe that we're not creating enough jobs. Britain's more flexible labour markets give us the best chance of creating large numbers of jobs. And I believe that people would rather have jobs, if they're looking for them, than anything else. At least that was spontaneous.
I can see a piece of paper in the back.
Yes. I'm very sorry to say I don't know what Clause 52 of the Act is about, but I'm sure it doesn't fit the description that you've given it. Well, there we are. It's very good. You're catching on.
Gentleman in the red shirt, next to the arm.
Well, I would much rather it had been 100%, but that's politics.
The gentleman in the front here.
I'm very sorry, I've said more times than I can now count that I'm not going to add to any speculation about the leadership of the Conservative Party, however cleverly or amusingly the questions may be framed.
Mr. Wilde.
Yeah.
Well, what you've said is scurrilous and possibly slanderous, and therefore I will make no comment on it. And on the matter of a referendum, I've never expressed an opinion on that.
The young lady in the centre here.
It isn't true that any of my colleagues has blamed single parents for anything at all. I think it is depressing that when people raise the subject of major social problems, such as the rate of teenage pregnancy in Britain, that they cannot do so without people rushing in to interpret their remarks as being an attack on single mothers. It is no such thing at all. They are simply raising what is a very important social issue. On the question of sex education, I think my colleague, the Secretary of State for Education, is publishing some proposals for consultation. I think he will want to take a wide range of views on the way in which we should proceed with sex education. But he wishes to make sex education a part of the curriculum in schools.
The gentleman next to the exit, Biden Bank.
Well, you would have to know what they were employed to do. If they were employed to save money, then of course that would not. But these consultants were not employed to save money. They were employed... Yes, in a way they were. They were employed to do things that government civil servants are unable to do for themselves. Very detailed and complex things, and you'll enjoy this one, very detailed and complex things, like the design of weapon systems. For that sort of thing, you need consultants. It doesn't lead to saving money. It leads to getting the job done, and the alternative is to have the job undone. That is not acceptable.
The gentleman next to the previous question.
No, I don't think so. I think that I think free political debate in universities is extremely important, and I think money from student unions to support free political debate is a perfectly proper use of money. What is not a proper use of money is, of course, to divert money that came either from students or from the taxpayer and put it into political causes. That is something quite different, and that is what the government has been concerned about. I call this a public meeting.
The gentleman here in the front, Women's Centre, that's you, yeah.
No, and I went into all of that the day that I said it, and it doesn't need to be gone over again and again.
Jim in the front here.
Why are there what? If you want to ask detailed questions, you should ask the minister responsible. But let me tell you the broad position. The broad position is that year by year, the amount of money that taxpayers are putting into higher education, into students' tuition fees in particular, is rising very steeply. And there has to be some limit to what can be financed by the taxpayer.
The person waving papers here. Can't see. To the gentleman.
I've not heard Norman Tebbit say that. I don't know whether that's an accurate quotation, so I won't comment on it.
The lady over here.
I am. I don't. I said I don't. I don't respond. Are we coming to an end?
Next question goes to the gentleman over here. Yes.
A PSBR is a product of three things. Decisions to spend extra amounts of money on priorities like education, the health service, and transport, which would have been sustainable within a balanced budget, except for the second factor, which is the recession. And then the third factor is that governments decide to borrow more during recession, because that is the operation of what's known as the economic stabilizers. In other words, when you go into recession, the fact that the government is spending more, whether it's on infrastructure or payments to the unemployed, is one of the things that helps to offset the effect of the cycle. And so you would expect governments to be borrowing during recession and to be moving towards surpluses during periods of recovery. So for all of those reasons, we ran up the PSBR of £50 billion. There are cyclical, world cyclical elements in all of this, but we have pursued policies in Britain of low inflation, of flexible labour markets, of keeping the costs on business low, which have enabled the British economy to respond quickly to the turnaround in the world economic cycle, and also to have an early effect of that economic recovery on the jobless total, faster and more evident in Britain than in most other countries that I can think of.
The young lady here.
I think you're referring to some press speculation, and that's all it is.
Leo.
Ah, second question. I do.
Chairman of here.
Yeah.
The Tories in Newham, from what I know, were not against Labour's immigration policies. I believe they were against Newham Labour Council's policies, which they regarded as discriminatory, the Council's policies, not the Labour Party's national policies. They stood against policies that they regarded as racist on the part of Newham Labour Council. I don't think nothing played into the BNP's hands. It was a source of great satisfaction to us that the BNP were defeated. Got one down there.
Yeah. Gentleman over here.
Well, the two are identical, but I'm not able to give you either one of them.
Gentleman over here.
Well, our plans for student loans were set out, I think, at the time of the budget, and they haven't changed since.
I can't tell the gender.
When people were asked what they thought of our administration in 1992, they responded by electing the Conservatives and giving them a higher proportion of the popular vote than we'd ever had before. That was the last time that the national government was up for election, and Democrats believe in democratic processes working their way through. This is a five-year parliament. We shall have to have an election within the next 3 years, and we shall see what public opinion is at the time. But before you get too excited, I would remind you that the Conservative Party has often found itself unpopular in mid-term and has often produced, for you, I take it, a very disappointing result on general election night. I think the same will happen again.
We've got time for two more questions. Put your hand up if you want to ask a question. I'll take the gentleman in the front here. You haven't got... It's not your question. Gentleman in the front, put your hand up.
The basis of my morality is that I believe that in my position, everything I do should be for the public good, that is my responsibility. That the ethics of government require that governments should believe that what they do is for the public good, that they should be willing to explain what they do in those terms, that they should be aware of the impact of the laws that they pass on the ethics of society. As to my own religious beliefs, I am a lapsed Catholic, and that's about as far as I want to go.
We've got time for one final question. I saw a hand over there before.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we are a parliamentary democracy, and the basis of decision making in Britain is through the decisions of Parliament, following on the elections of members of Parliament from constituencies to Parliament. Now, occasionally in the past, we have supplemented that with referendums on key constitutional questions. But as I've said before, on the matter of whether we will have one in the future, that is not a matter on which I've ever expressed an opinion. No.
Right, on behalf of the LSE Conservatives, I'd like to thank all of you for taking time up from your revisions, and particularly like to thank Ms. Patila for coming along today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.